You have the old familiar handout, where we have been camped out on these two verses for some time. God's wrath happening now. God is fed up, the earlier verses said, with the fact that He left in the creation enough indice of His existence that failure to recognize His existence, worship Him, and be thankful, just thankful for life in this vast universe on this earth He prepared for us, ticks Him off. He's tired of it. He's tired of that tendency to rule Him out of everything. Now, there are two great miracle events that the Hebraic Christian tradition embrace. The Hebraic tradition, also shared with Christianity, is the miracle of creation. That God spoke and nothing became what is. And thus, His Word, more powerful than anything else, bringing what we see and feel into existence. And as the Creator, we're the creation. And the least He expects, recognition, worship, thanksgiving. I didn't say this. God said it through Paul. He's fed up. And I've told you many times of a sect in the Near East that says God can always be counted on to be good, so they worship a serpent because He's not able to be counted on as good, and they've kissed the head of that serpent until the bronze head's worn off, and they do not believe that He's superior to God. They just believe God can always be counted on to do what's right, so you don't have to appease Him. He'll do what's right because of who He is. But this other character, you got to stay on His good side, because He doesn't have any decency or any goodness or any of the traits of God. We all tend to take God for granted like that. It's shocking to be confronted with a statement, the wrath of God is revealed against all a Sabian who don't recognize His presence and trust Him, which is the only way for righteousness to be ours. And we're in the verses where God is now gone beyond simply saying He's mad to describing the results of His anger. Now, there is a wrath to come, but right now there's a wrath that is the removal of sins. It's in these verses. Because, having known God, His presence capable of being at least recognized, and God must be part of the equation of our philosophy of life, God being ruled out by people who know better. They didn't glorify God, nor thank Him, but became vain. And last Sunday I concentrated on that word, Matthias, and traced it into a basket of Hebrew words, or the previous Sunday rather, a basket of Hebrew words, just waiting for this Greek word, Matthias. Its root is hot air, breath of wind. But it's an evil, self-deceptive state where you are going to come up with any kind of formula to explain anything that exalts yourself and thus deceives yourself and is anti-God at its root. It's always an evil kind of thought. Now, I've said probably 15 times in the last few weeks, I agree with R.C. Sproul. Atheism is not based on facts. It's a seeking for facts to support a previous state of mind, which is psychological. We don't want a boss. Because God the Creator, God the Lord, and the God capable of deciding who you'll take and who he won't, is a God we don't want to have to contend with. What man doesn't want is God's sovereignty. We don't want a sovereign. We want a God that pleases us. We don't want to have to face up to the fact that he is God. And what's important is that we please him. And that attitude that rules God out has made God mad. And he's tired of it. After the predeterminate counsel of God, from the lamb's flame to the foundation of the world, through the creation of the world for Adam and his descendants, through their failure, that lamb is the fail-safe in the woven types of the Old Testament, comes to culmination in the death and resurrection of Christ, and a new age is upon us. God's fed up. He's fed up. Fed up with man that absolutely wants to take him out of the garden. The age-old problem, he already dealt with Adam and Eve. He can give them everything, but if he says no to one thing, that's what they got to have. And that motivated them was if they'd seize that one thing, they would be like God. Man wants to be God, doesn't want to worship God. And God, who knows the heart, is fed up, and he therefore were in the age where people like that are the present tense object of God's wrath, and the nature of that wrath is to take a certain kind of sense from them. It is a God-given, or we use the word given, so let me repeat it again, a God-given gift, the capacity to even want to come to God, the capacity to recognize God. It's a gift. That's why God can be so intolerant of the failure to do it. Because he put the gift in us. The ability to see. I mean, trouble getting faith out of a child. But the prince of this world snatches our sanity first. Focuses in on making us take a natural trait of self-preservation and turn it into self-worship. And as Jesus said, no man cometh to the Father save the Spirit drawing. That drawing capacity, that faculty to see the divine in anything is actually withdrawn. And the mind becomes darkened. That's why it's dangerous to trifle with God. It's dangerous to trifle with the knowledge you have. It's dangerous to put off and presumptuously think, well, God's so good and anxious to have me, I can pick my time. Everybody's heard of an unpardonable sin. Those being described here as the object of God's wrath have already committed it. There is no one deed. No one deed that exhausts the meaning of the unpardonable sin. I grew up in a fundamental church where people would do anything. They would sooner commit incest with their mother than say, I blaspheme the Holy Ghost. Those words that had about as much real meaning in their mind, most of them didn't even know what the word blaspheme meant. And they had little acquaintance with the Holy Ghost. But this was the checkbox mentality. Every sin is forgiven. Say blasphemy against the Holy Ghost. Well, the context was a group of religious leaders who just a few chapters earlier had said of Jesus, no man can do what he's doing except God be with him. And yet, in spite of that confessed awareness, now in front of a crowd, the same Jesus that they had attributed to God his miracle-working ability, they say he does it through Beelzebub. This was a willful turning on knowledge already had, and thus that became, in that occasion, a blasphemy against the Holy Ghost, to credit the works of the Holy Ghost to Satan. But that's not the only verse about it. There's a sin unto death in one of the epistles. If we sin willfully, there remaineth no more remission. And there is where we're coming in Romans. It'll become even more clear as we go along. A state where God, because we willfully worship the creature instead of the Creator, God turns us over to a strong delusion, and we believe a lie and are damned. And that's why I've often said to you that unpardonable sin can have multiple routes, different kinds of behavior, alternate activities. I don't know which one is it. I don't know which putting the creature first is the last one he'll tolerate. I do know what the unpardonable sin state of being is. When you've committed it, you're turned over. When you've committed it, the warning, my spirit will not always strive with man, has been fulfilled. When you've committed it, you're in the state where the Spirit won't draw you anymore. He's done with you. He's turned you over. And no man cometh to the Father save the Spirit drawing. When you've committed it, you won't want to come to God. Those deathbed experiences that evangelists used to scare us teenagers with when I was a boy are not true. Oh, on a deathbed, as they'd warn us at altar call and take the clock and say, you got 5 minutes to get up here and make it right. And if you don't, you might be one of those that will be on the deathbed crying out to God for forgiveness. And God, save me, but it's too late. You committed the unpardonable sin. When you've committed the unpardonable sin, you won't cry out to God for forgiveness. You don't want to come to God. You've just lost that faculty. You've lost the receiver, and furthermore, the transmitter is no longer putting any juice in. The spirit is gone from pulling you. The faculty to see the divine is gone. You're senseless. Your heart is made senseless in, to borrow a current phrase, the God nodule's gone dead. You don't respond. And I'm illustrating, as I camp out on scientism, and today I will illustrate that state. Paul says the wrath of God on those that turn from him and worship the creature instead of the Creator, he withdraws. He darkens the mind, withdraws the faculty, and you have a senseless heart. Sense is gone. Insight. That which is tunneled toward God, I repeat, the God module, if there is such a thing, the God recognizing capacity is gone. You are turned over to a strong delusion. I don't doubt the capacities of these men. They're geniuses. I don't even doubt their honesty in this sense. I believe that they believe some of their stupid ideas. I really believe that they are seeking answers, but they're as blind men trying to describe an elephant, because the capacity's been withdrawn. And it becomes obvious when you see brilliant men in every other area turn idiot in their pronouncements on ultimate things, ultimate reality, and their attitudes about God. Their objective ability to consider every option and to falsify every theory turns screwball as they turn toward God. They become irrational on the subject of God. And they become name callers and argue to the man and put down anyone that even thinks about God having an equal role in the equation. Which is why I, having earned the credentials of a PhD at Stanford and met these people and been fed this stuff, and have earned the right to stand up and say, you've been putting me, God, the Christian church, and the Christian faith down long enough, so let's have a little put down mano-a-mano. And that's what I'm doing. Because they have been calling those who have faith in God somehow less than intelligent. I'm going to demonstrate, as I've been doing, they're less than intelligent on this subject by their own standards and criteria. I picked up the paper illustrating the tunnel that Houston Smith talked about and we've been talking about. Tonight, on the Discovery Channel, who first learned from me that people were interested in deep subjects, a portrait of what Jesus might actually have looked like. That's good enough. For 3 hours, Jesus, the complete story, the title says it all. Now they're going to give us the complete story. 2,000 years of religious teaching has led you all astray. Now someone with their senseless mind darkened. And look at what the verse says. Not recognizing God, they became vain, that is, self-deceptively evil and worthless, in the dialogismois. Notice in the middle of that word is logis, which is the root for logos, has the leg or lobe to choose, and to choose with words, and to choose out from among other options, to choose with words. And through the choosing of words, these self-deceived people, choosing words and making deliberate decisions that leave God out as an insult, if you will, since that root word in ancient Greek philosophy meant someone who stood between the unknowable God and man and was the mediating transition who could tell us what we need to know about that God. And John opened his gospel saying, in the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God. The one who could tell us all we need to know about God was facing me, God, and turned from that and struck a tent in human flesh and came to tell us all we need to know about God. But now these self-appointed, unwilling to recognize the sovereign, self-deceived and evil in their heart, with their minds darkened through their words, their reasonings, professing to be wise sophists, they become morons. It walks like a duck, talks like a duck, quacks like a duck, most likely a duck. Acts like a moron, talks like a moron, most likely have become just what God said they were. So these verses are illustrating how science, the product of the wonderful gift that God has given us in the capacity to know, articulate, and communicate, turned into a self-worshipping state where the creature was worshipped instead of the Creator, instead of honoring God in our knowledge, God is ruled out of the equation. We put ourselves in His place, and with self-deceived and evil, self-serving dialogues, through words, we reveal ourselves, those in that state, through their very words, reveal themselves to be senseless, with darkened minds regarding the things of God and ultimate reality, and thinking and professing themselves to be wise, they become morons. Well, here's a sample. This is what you're going to see. Ancient cities of Jerusalem, Bethlehem, and Nazareth constructed and deconstructed noisily at the click of a computer keyboard as the three-hour documentary recreates Jesus' world. Archaeology, astronomy, anthropology, forensic science, and biblical research. And my bet is you'll see some Jesus seminar people on this. Lend credence to Christian belief and sometimes to challenge it. The frame of reference is already there. It stands or falls on us. We determine its validity. Finally, at the end of the third hour, there's a piece de resistance. An artist, a medical artist in Manchester, constructs a bust of what Jesus might actually have looked like. Now, there's a strange twist that when they found that folded piece of linen out of the kingdom of Edessa, claimed to have had the imprint and the image of Christ's face, that's the route to the Shroud of Turin, without bringing all that up again, because we've covered that earlier. All Christian art simultaneously took on, from that one piece of linen cloth, portraying Jesus' face based on that. But now we have a medical artist going to tell us finally what he looks like, so you won't go to the wrong person if you happen to get up there. What a lure it is! He looks a little bit like he just got out of an insane asylum and he can't believe what he sees. Look close. Try to get that in focus. But what a lure it is, this Jesus. Not the sleek. Notice the types of emotive words we call this in philosophy, to put down tradition, and superior type snot when describing their view. What a lure it is, this new medical artist, impression of a village idiot. Now we've replaced it, because this is not the sleek, thin, and decidedly white Jesus rooted in European art. This is a Jesus of science. That settles it, folks. We don't need to go any further in this message. That's it. Science has decided. This is a Jesus of science and educated guesswork. I tried that once in Las Vegas and lost my shirt. Now, That ought to give the fundamentalists something to chew on all afternoon. Educated guesswork built from a first century skull and from conjecture about a hot climate, hard work, the short hair and close-cropped beard styles of the time, and Jesus' Afro-Asiatic bloodlines. Now, if you want a black Jesus in order to make sections of the world feel better, talk to God about it. Maybe He'll send another one. The Ethiopian Jews claim a descent from Solomon through the Queen of Sheba. But I'm quite sure that the Sephardic and the Ashkenazan Jews do not much trace an African heritage. In fact, I'd like to tell you folks that we Celtic people, descendants of the Joseph line, started out half Egyptian. So I'm more African than you probably, Harold. You know, all this attempt to reduce Christianity down into this mishmash of racial conflict, when there's only one blood that matters in Christianity, and that's the shed blood of Jesus. And that's the same color in all of us, red. Now listen, the result, and by the way, don't tell me about the way they wore their beards and hair. In those days, Jesus was a Nazarite. This ignoramus doesn't even know what that is. Because, you know, he's too smart to study anything about Christianity. That's like trying to study Einstein's formulas by reading Peanuts. I think I hate them worse than women, engineers, and sound people. I mean, these superiors, not Paul once said, I'm so tired of people being fools, I'm going to be one and brag a while. Pharisee of the Pharisees, I'm a Jew, I'm ahead of all of them. Last time I checked, Stanford's still number one. Last time I checked, I got the youngest PhD coming out of that school in the School of Education with its requirements. That's the last time I checked. Somebody reminded me the other night who was there with me. They want to give credence to some of the best minds in the history of mankind that have studied the facts of Christianity and been gripped thereby, and quit coming in with their snideness because of the successes of science in this 20th century and now the 21st. Then I'll give them equal respect and we'll discuss on a level field, as I'm going to do in a few minutes. Right now, I'm illustrating they've become morons. Morons. Don't try to fit Jesus into a routine pattern when he wasn't routine. The result is admittedly a rough guess, not the face of Jesus exactly. It's a Jesus who appears more construction worker than hippie. Both of those were emotional words. I mean, I don't look on Jesus as hippie, because most hippies don't wash feet. Nor allow them to be washed. When did you last see a hippie with his feet washed? And none of them have been baptized in their whole life. They haven't been near water. Get on the planet with me, folks. They're going to play the fool, so am I. It's a Jesus who appears more construction worker than hippie. This is no blow to his divinity. Patronizing. This is no blow to his divinity. We just reduced him to nothing, but this is no blow to his divinity. But it does invite a radical rearrangement of visualization cells in the brain. Talk about BS. But it does invite a radical rearrangement of visualization cells in the brain. When this, was this a man or woman, whoever it is, when they make love, my Lord, the companion must be to sleep for to get to the point. But that's at the close. For starters, the special questions, the manger birth scene. And suggests that the star of Bethlehem wasn't a star at all, rather the planet Jupiter. Then they rearrange dates because they find Jupiter in a certain place on April 17th and 6 B.C. Jesus was born 4 B.C. And the key thing to determine the birth is an eclipse, not Jupiter. But they must explain in some scientific way. I can just see the special effects as Jupiter's lined up. So they got to rearrange the birth of Jesus to a time when Jupiter was in rare alignment with the constellation Aries from an earthly vantage point, and the constellation was important to ancient astrologers who looked, well, this is a new one, who looked there for a sign of the Messiah. As for no room at the inn, the Greek word for inn is the same as for upper room. Uh-oh. You better study his Greek a little more. And also understand cases and tenses, pronouns and definite articles. No room upstairs is nowhere close to no room at the inn. But again, it sounds intelligent, doesn't it? When you read it the first time, and well, I don't know Greek, so my Lord, I mean, I bet this guy's got 5 PhDs in Greek literature. And you know, my computer can write Greek letters. Why didn't he write it out in here? Well, I'm sure they'll have a field day on the special with it. The suggestion is that Mary and Joseph weren't turned away by an ancient Holiday Inn. He's cute, isn't he? But staying with relatives in Bethlehem and sleeping downstairs in an area shared with the animals. The matter of the virgin birth is perplexing. A few other eye-openers from the special. A scholar described Jesus' decision to ride a donkey through the east gate of Jerusalem in the climatic days of his life as a calculated act to fulfill a messianic prophecy, one of several. And they're having a big deal about the shape of the table. And science lends some credence, they throw us this, to the account that Jesus perspired blood, Garden of Gethsemane. Columbia University expert here tells about broken capillaries. The cross and the crucifixion could well have been a board nailed to a stump with no olive tree. They're real great Roman historians. I mean, Josephus probably gives us a better description of a Roman crucifixion. He was back in those days. This smells of Jesus' seminar. There is even a chance, and this brings me to the message today, there is even a chance through the special mainly dismissed, though the special mainly dismisses it, that the narcotic herb mandrake was administered to Jesus on the cross. It could have created an illusion of death and explained the resurrection in non-religious terms. Jesus, the complete story, reasons that something extraordinary happened. If not for the resurrection, it's hard to explain the potency and rapid growth of early Christianity. Throw us a bone now. Some of these materials are kind of classic, some conclusions supported but no more than speculation and thin evidence, bunched together for maximum impact on Easter Sunday. It's still of necessity an incomplete story. That's because in the end, Christianity rests on the same bedrock it has always occupied, faith, not scientific inquiry. In other words, don't even try to come into our domain. We are God's here. Faith is for you dummies and stay. We don't even have a room upstairs. Go down with the animals. Like the Jesus you serve. At least this program rattles old notions and provokes viewers to contemplate fresh approaches to the life of Jesus. Why? A fresh approach would be look for the Jesus that's there. Because that ain't been done in this generation for some time. Morons. I told you last Sunday. I don't care. Let this guy, this Greek expert. Pick any upper room he wants and show me his source. In that source, I will find Jesus making these claims I listed last week. And the fifth one, if you don't like six, he said there was something wrong with the world that only his death would set right. And the way his death would set it right, which would be six making this seven, is his life was a ransom in a context, as I said last Sunday, where a ransom was what you paid to restore something that had been lost. He made these ridiculous claims about himself that remove him from the category of respected founders of religion who never made such ridiculous claims about themselves, and they're all intrinsic. Give me your source and I will find in that source, intrinsic to it, these impossible claims that make him either a nut who is good because he honestly believes these nutty things about himself, or he's a con artist supreme who is wise enough to know better, but convincing his followers, like this guy says, manipulating to fulfill prophecy, a deceit, and there is no other choice. Have the guts to say, I want nothing to do with Jesus. Have the honesty to say, I don't know anything about him. Have the guts, I repeat, to say, I'm willing to risk. But don't run around putting me down because I believe in Jesus as a result of hard research and having gained the tools to do it, when you're ignorant of the only Jesus that ever existed in history. Create any Jesus you want, but put a byline on it. Just like this medical artist, made by me. Nothing to do with reality. Made by me. Because the only Jesus of history went around making claims about himself impossible for a mortal man to do and be judged good and wise. And when they say he's a good and wise teacher but not divine, they reveal their ignorance. Only the God can make these kinds of claims about himself. When I came to that conclusion, I knew my professors were feeding me a false Christ, one that didn't exist. And this is the only Christ of history, one who went around perfection incarnate, authority incarnate, with knowledge of the eternal world from the inside, putting himself and what we do with him, not what he says, worshiping him, the center of the religious universe. Something wrong with all of us, something lost from all of us, made right and bought back by his death, and confirming the right to make those claims by saying, they'll put me in the grave and 3 days later, I will come out. And as I said last Sunday, if you made those kind of claims about yourself, and you came out of the grave and ascended off in the blue, I'd take another look at you. I don't need any broader definition of God than perfection incarnate. I don't need to go anywhere. It's a lifetime search to find His words, because all authority is seated in Him. All of it confirmed with the resurrection. So I set out on a search. I had to confirm. I did an undergraduate major in history, so I know that historic certainty is impossible. Historic certainty, by definition, means every logically possible kind of evidence is there to be had. Well, the minute the time moved on and an eyewitness is no longer there, that logically possible kind of evidence is gone. It's true of any historic event. That's why we use the word history. It's something that's gone by. Thus, all historians know historic certainty is relative. It's based upon preponderance of evidence, amassing evidence, and you always have relative proof the moment that eyewitness is gone. At least that much is gone now. But psychological certainty comes from being exposed to the evidence, and you move along in agnosticism, not sure, and eventually you remain agnostic or you reject and turn anti. It's like a jury trial. You're not sure. You're tested when you're selected on the panel if you have any presuppositions, any prior attitudes that will tinge your objectivity. And then you're cloistered, and the evidence comes in. You're agnostic to start. Eventually, evidence begins to affect your thought processes, and you come to relative degrees, but some people come to a certain degree of psychological certainty. Without exposure to the evidence, you're in no position to draw an opinion. And my intolerance, as I've said, of the current scientism view, they have an a priori decision. A miracle, a resurrection certainly is that, a miracle cannot happen, therefore anybody says it did is either lying, gullible, or telling some weird, untrue tale, not worth reading for an objective person who's looking for evidence. Because a miracle can't happen, therefore it didn't happen. Anybody that reports it's not worth reading because it can't happen, therefore it didn't happen. Blah, blah, blah. It's arguing in a circle. You set out and state your belief before you. That's not looking at the evidence. I said, any objective Christian can say, and I refuse to concede that faith and science have to separate. Science provides facts. Interpretation follows that, and God has already agreed that He would give one sign. It's a sign on the stage of history. It's a sign that's a historic fact. It's not based upon something subjective, like I want you to believe because of an experience I've had. Christianity is not based on Paul's experience in healing of blindness, and he didn't go to Rome, put a front page paper in the Roman Gazette and appear on channel 51 of the religious network in Rome with pre-arrival ads, come and hear about the man that was blind and healed. I delivered unto you first of all, he said to the Corinthians, that which I also received. How that Christ died for our sins according to the Scripture and rose again according to the Scripture. And after that was seen, he lists the appearances, ending with above 500 brethren at once. And if the resurrection didn't occur, our faith is vain. And we are false witnesses of God because we testify that God raised him up. I repeat, they asked Jesus for a sign. He said there'll only be one. He pointed the sign of Jonah and typed the resurrection. God bent down and condescended even to this scientific generation. There is a sign. You can look at it the way you look at any other objective fact. You marshal the evidence. You set up the pattern of reasoning. You settle the issue the way you would settle whether or not Caesar said, "You too, Brutus." In fiction or fact. Whether or not Caradoc renamed Caractacus, defeated every Roman general, and whether or not he was captured because he was betrayed by a woman, by the way. And whether or not Tacitus record, the heathen historian of Rome, is true that he stood before the Senate having been paraded as a domitar, a gift to the emperor as the greatest warrior ever to hold off the best that Rome could offer. And Tacitus records a speech where he said if there'd been no Caradoc, Rome would not have the opportunity to display to the world the way they could treat a conquered hero that they'd never been able to defeat. And his speech so moved the Roman Senate. According to Tacitus, they voted him house arrest. His daughter was married to the emperor. And Gladys, his daughter, becomes Claudius. And she was married to a Roman senator who is the Rufus Pudens you encounter in the last chapter of this book of Romans. Now that's facts to be examined. I'm either telling you a fairy tale, or you can reach a psychological certainty as you look at the evidence whether or not there's a basis for this. God deigned to let us subject the one sign to the same kind of test. And he gave us the faculty. Just as he gave us the faculty to recognize his hand in the creation, unless you are emptied out and become a moron. And the further we look into the vastness of space and into the micro infinitely smallness of reality, the more the mystery. And when I return, as I will in the weeks ahead, to information theory, to where the first cell of life has got a program telling it what to do that could fill 30 volumes like Encyclopedia Britannica, until the Darwinists are saying it has patterns of activity that could suggest the appearance of design. Morons. God allows us, hopefully having gotten our attention, by intruding onto the stage of this earth with such outlandish claims that only a God could make them, and then I will show my right to do it by coming out of that grave. And you can examine that, and I did. But you've got to do it intelligently. Can't do it like a moron. Now, if you're going to discuss whether or not I preached too long today, you're going to have to assume that at least I stood up here and talked. You furthermore are going to assume there's a city of Los Angeles and that the cathedral sits here between Olympic and 9th on Broadway. And you're going to assume you were here. Well, now, before we talk about how long I preached, I want proof you were here. And you give me that, and I will be a moron like God's senses departed from a person. And I would say one of the most profound philosophic questions of all time. They've proven you exist. You can't prove that. You have to assume it. And I've never been motivated enough to prove I exist to walk in front of a bus. But it's an assumption. We in philosophy call this frames of reference. You cannot have intelligent discussion until certain things are taken for granted, and then on that basis you move on. That's why in a courtroom, the judge has the ability to adjudge evidence. Exhibit A and Exhibit B. And then all this evidence becomes the basis for the thought process of the jury. And it takes weeks to go through a trial. Now, I'm telling you that I only have 30 minutes now to give the evidence of the resurrection. If I'm going to carry on a discussion with anybody about the resurrection, we are going to take for granted certain things and not debate those things while we discuss the resurrection. Follow me? I mean, we can maybe debate whether you're here or some double. Or maybe you are an identical twin and never revealed it. And you want him to pay tithe today and not you. But that's another subject. We take certain things for granted. For example, I don't want to talk about whether Jesus rose from the dead or not if you don't accept the fact Jesus lived. Now, even that newspaper believes that. They're trying to tell us what he looked like. It's much easier to prove to everybody's satisfaction, not just with speech making, but with the same kind of reasoned discourse I'm going to do on the resurrection, it's much easier to prove Jesus lived than it is to prove that he rose from the dead. You'll concede me that, won't you? I mean, if I can prove to your satisfaction that if he lived, he died and rose again, but the only problem you've got is you're not convinced he even lived, you've made my task easy. I can prove he lived a lot easier than I can convince you he raised. Furthermore, he not only lived, he was crucified. Crucified, the hands of the Romans, because of charges brought by Jewish leaders. Not the Jewish people, Jewish leaders. Leaders are the same when they get caught up in their glut for power and perpetuation of their position. Leadership. If you don't believe that he was crucified at the hands of the Romans, charged by Jewish leaders, that's much easier to prove than the resurrection. Just as Jesus lives, much easier to prove than how he died. But each of these can be approached the same way. Look at the evidence. It's a historic fact. Let the evidence make an impact. Number three, he was considered dead. Considered dead. Doesn't mean he's dead. Considered dead, which opens the way for what the newspaper article said about the swoon theory. He was considered dead. I don't know many people that survive a Roman crucifixion. On top of that, nobody debates much the Romans to make sure he was dead, otherwise they'd have broken his bones, as the custom. And again, this is fact you can research. They've break the bones to ensure the death. His bones were not broken. They pierced him with a sword to make sure that he was dead. He was taken down from the cross, buried somewhere. You don't normally do that unless you're considered dead or somebody's doing a scam on you. Next. He was buried. Buried in a known, accessible tomb. Got that? I'm not going to elaborate anymore because I want to hurry to the point of the message. These I'm taking for granted. Five. He was preached, raised, ascended, and that the tomb was empty. All three things were being preached. Well, I don't believe that. Well, I'm doing it today. And I'm saying, and it's easier to prove this than maybe anything of all the list. He was preached, raised, ascended, tomb empty, in the city where he was crucified, and thereafter all around. Six is simple, logical, common sense. If you assume the fact that Jewish leaders brought the charge, and uncontested is the charge was blasphemy, because they understood the claims that Jesus was making, and for any mortal man to make these claims is to blaspheme, in Jewish view, and that's why Caiaphas rent his high priestly garments, because it was a sin against God, a blasphemy. He said, I need to hear no more. These Jewish leaders were on the hook. Their power and their position hinged upon this message not being true. If the one they accused of blasphemy for those claims came out of that tomb, who wants to hear them preach anymore? Theirs was more than an intellectual interest. For them it was bread and butter, blood and life. So common sense tells you the Jewish leaders were more concerned on part of Jewish leaders than you and I sitting here today 2,000 years removed. Now that's a logical deduction, assuming these other facts. Seven, these disciples who preached were persecuted horribly for preaching this message. Now later in the Roman Empire, Christians became a scapegoat for persecution just because they were Christians. But every record is united, and again, it's a fact more easy to demonstrate than the resurrection, that the earliest preachers were persecuted for proclaiming the resurrection. And if they would stop proclaiming the resurrection, persecution ceased. Which proves the Jewish concern, because these leaders are the ones that said, stop preaching! And Peter comes back, you desired a murderer to be granted unto you, and hang the Prince of Life on a tree, but God raised him from the dead. It's a resurrection message Peter's preaching in Acts 2. God raised him up, whereof we all are witnesses, he said, standing on the streets of Jerusalem. Eight, these are facts, I'm assuming, tomb empty. Common sense tells me that. If the Jewish leaders brought the charge, and the preaching now makes fools of them, they had more concern than you and I would have to dispel the message. All they had to do was go to the tomb, and it was a known accessible tomb, and if there was a body in it, they'd have put it in a cart and run it through the streets of Jerusalem, saying, these men are liars. Common sense tells you that. Second, a little more indirect, it wasn't until really Constantine's mother reopened inquiry into Jerusalem and the icon worship began to develop, the people got concerned about where Jesus' tomb was. You can travel all through Israel and you find tombs of people much more ancient than Jesus. Even the opponents of Jesus that proclaim he's good and wise, based upon sayings and deeds apart from these things, if there had been a body in the tomb not only would have been a proof text against the message, it would have been a place to revere. The fact that nobody knew where the tomb was by the 4th or 5th century proved the tomb became unimportant. There wasn't any body in it. Tombs are only important if there's a body in it. Now it's a tourist place, and the church argues. The church, shared by three faiths, says this is where he was buried. And Gordon, plotting from what he believed to be Golgotha, protected through the years by an Arab cemetery next to the bus station years ago in downtown Jerusalem, Gordon plotted what is called Gordon's tomb, where most of the Protestants who visit Israel today go and have communion and see it. So there's two tombs. And the church is still fighting which one was he in, because the tomb became unimportant. If there had been a body in it, it would have been used to explode the message, and they would have remembered where the tomb was later. They'd have made it a shrine. That tomb was empty. These eight facts are much easier to demonstrate than the resurrection. I'm not willing to discuss the resurrection until these are taken for granted. Just like I wouldn't discuss anything in science without the basic standard model theory, whatever the presuppositions are, taken for granted. This is disciplined looking at a fact proclaimed in history, which presumes, as necessary preconditions to that fact, these items. You don't like these items? We'll talk about these things. Much easier to prove than the resurrection. Now, the fact that it's preached produced a lot of theories to explain the preaching. We have theories. Apparently, all these theories assume Jesus lived, and he was crucified, died, and priests ascended. The first theory, disciples stole the body. Disciples took the body. Second theory, Jewish leaders took the body. Third theory, Roman authorities. Roman authorities took the body. That's static from rubbing on something. That's my mic here, right? I'm rubbing. Okay. I lost a little. That's it. Well, I haven't got time to put it on. You know, you sound people with all your genius, you can't figure out how to drill a hole through a sponge big enough that it'll stay on this microphone. I mean, I'm an expert in that department. You can take that anywhere you want to take it. Roman authorities stole the body. Or, women went to the wrong tomb. Five, hallucinations. Six, this spoon theory, resuscitation. He wasn't really dead. He revived either through some spatial mystery mix that he practiced with Lazarus, and that he set the stage, and thus he is a wise con man, as I have said, if he's not God. And he therefore practiced on Lazarus, and Lazarus was you know, that's quite a risk poor Lazarus took to prove the method. At least he was wise enough to have a fall guy before he tried it. Of course, Lazarus wasn't crucified. But the resuscitation theory, that he wasn't really dead, and then the coolness of the tomb he revived. Seventh theory, the disciples bet on the wrong horse, followed what they thought was the Messiah, believed in Jesus, believed his claims, and lo and behold, they bet on a fake horse. He's crucified. Now, how do they save face? As the Jewish leaders need to save face and stop this preaching and prove that it didn't happen, these disciples, having bet on a wrong horse, have got to make up a story that's plausible. And that's what they were doing in the 7 weeks between the resurrection or the crucifixion on Passover and Pentecost, when the church was born and Peter began to preach. As they used this 7 weeks to construct this fabulous story, that's all a lie. They're just a bunch of liars. These disciples were a pack of liars. Eight, they're just honest reporters. Just telling what they saw and experienced. Honest guys. Now, of course, Jesus' seminar would try to get us to believe that this was all reported in the 3rd century, and Matthew and Mark didn't really write it. Well, then they're liars already going out the gate. Of course, that's false, because we can trace the manuscripts back to 60 and 70 A.D., and I guess I got more manuscripts out here in this cathedral than those guys can lay their hands on. So again, I'm being as arrogant as Paul was, and as I approach my 72nd year, I suffer fools less than I did in earlier years. I'm intolerant of ignorance being peddled as intelligence. I'm not a scientist. But I bring the books out here when I talk on the subject, and you can check for yourself. I'm tired of these people making pronouncements about Jesus when they don't know nothing about him. Here is a perfect case in point of the faculty removed, of the God module, if there is such a thing, gone, of a perverse, evil bent, through deliberate choice of wrong words, to rule God out of the universe, which proves what the wrath of God is against those that know better and turn on God, and thus he removes the faculty, and professing to be wise, they become morons. How moronic! My PhD's in philosophies of education. I know basic rules of logic. There's only two. And don't talk to me about objectivity. The more you study a subject, the more certain you become. An objective person that can't give you an opinion doesn't know much about the subject, because opinions come with knowledge. I'm very opinionated because I've got a lot of knowledge on this. There's only two. There's only two explanations. Just as you've got a choice with the only Jesus in history. If he's not God, he's nuts or a con artist. And to be able to make the claims, and he's that's a pretty good word. He cannot be wrecked and pulled away irretrievably, embedded into every record. Intrinsic to it, these self-claims that make him a madman or a con artist, but if true, make him God. Confirmed by the resurrection. You got that startling alternate on the only Christ of history. Likewise, there's only two possible explanations for the preaching. They didn't just preach resurrection. They didn't just preach an empty tomb. They preached an ascension. Even, I don't know what being an expert in the Dead Sea Scrolls has got to do with Christ, because he was not an Essene. And he certainly wasn't a teacher of righteousness. If anybody was, his so-called brother James. The changing faces of Jesus. It doesn't look like that medical artist, though. Like Giza Burns. Even his modern view recognizes they preached ascension as well as resurrection. He makes a bad mistake saying that Christ has ascended in the last chapter of Luke. He ascends on Easter Sunday, the same day he rose. And then Acts, written by the same author, has him ascend 40 days later. That again is nice circular rhetoric. Sounds good, like all men have two legs, this has two legs, therefore it's a man. No, it isn't. It's a duck. That's rhetoric, not logic. Jesus ascended many times during the 40 days. The record at Luke is an ascension that didn't have the accompanying angels. It wasn't the last ascension. He went up and down. He said to the lady who saw him at the garden tomb, "Don't touch me, I haven't yet ascended to the Father." Yet in after that first ascension, which had to fulfill the type of the propitiation in the outer court and the propitiatory, the place where it's accepted in the Holy of Holies, that ascension had a specific purpose, but he didn't just camp out in isolation during the 40 days, he came and went. If he isn't any harder to do 40 ascensions than one. And I wouldn't sleep on the ground after the years I'd spent there if I had my bed in heaven I could go home to each night. Don't be overly ridiculous as they try to find some little nitpicking thing. There's only two answers here. They lied or told the truth. Disciples stole the body. Well, if they're dead, they lied. Okay? Jewish leaders stole the body, took the body. If these facts were assumed, he would have been put in a cart, the dead body, and paraded through the streets. It's untenable. Roman authorities took the body. Jesus' seminar favorite, out there on a pile where dogs eat the flesh. Baloney. The influence they had on Pilate and the Roman authorities were such, that's the first place they went. And this is why the guards said, "We went to sleep while we slept." They had guards with a seal because it had been rumored, in their view, he would raise. That's why the guards were there. Roman authorities, if they had taken the body, Jewish leaders would have gone to them based upon their concern, produced the body. That was it. Women went to the wrong tomb. Ridiculous. Had nothing to do with the ascension. And if they went to the wrong tomb, come on, ladies. We're going to the right tomb now. It's all over. Hallucinations? I'm told that Josh McDowell used to sit when I preached on this years ago. This is a story from Craig Lamp. And took the notes as I preached on this subject years ago, even before I came here, because everywhere I went, I always would dedicate one night to this subject, and produced evidence that demands a verdict. There's whole chapters in here as he expanded it, went to many of the sources that I had to go through over a 3.5 year period and produce this book. But he has a whole section on the hallucination theory, from C.S. Lewis to scientists and psychologists. Simple facts are, you don't have hallucinations without a previous state of mind, every record showing they're not in that necessary state of mind. And hallucinations don't end abruptly at the same time, with diverse people in diverse places. But I don't even need that. I really think he spends too much time on it. Because the facts assume empty tomb, ascension, and if it was hallucinations, there would have been a body in the tomb. That's the way. I know you're grieving, Peter. Let me take you to the tomb and let's get closure on this. The empty tomb blows it. Revived, you don't do that. And it wasn't a sick, near collapse, crucified Jesus. It was a healthy, live, well Jesus and an ascending Jesus. Ascension is not taken into account with resuscitation. I mean, I want that mandrake if you can fly off to heaven with it. It's untenable. The whole message is all of these theories are, don't bother us. We know faith and science. I know you, I don't want to offend your belief. There is, as that article says, there is a possible other solution. There is an explanation for the sermon. We don't want to put the disciples down. But, you know, the women went to the wrong tomb, maybe. Maybe they just had hallucinations. Maybe he got in that cold tomb and revived. Sounds plausible, doesn't it? Because they don't want to say. They don't have the guts to say. The only Jesus of history is a nut or a madman. They don't have the guts to say. This whole thing is based upon a pack of liars or an astounding report by honest people of what they saw and experienced that deserves a fair, honest look. They want to shove it off. It can't be, therefore it wasn't. Therefore we come up with some moronic explanation to just shut up these faith idiots here. Well, you got a choice, friends. The only Jesus that existed in history is either a nut or a madman or what he said he was. Divine. And these disciples that are telling this story are either honest men reporting what they saw, or they're lying rats. Here's why I don't think they're liars. Internal evidence, real fast. Historians have a way of looking at what they call internal evidence to check the veracity of a reporter. Three different sources have Jesus out near Bethsaida saying, "Where can we buy bread?" Another source has him ask Philip where to buy bread. Now, why ask Philip? Then a third source tells us Philip was born near this place, so he's the logical choice that would know where to buy bread. Three different records written by liars, if we assume they're liars, in three different remote connections of the world, possibly never seeing one another again, reporting an incident like that from three different pens suggests accurate reporting. Everybody agrees Mark was tutored after his failure with Paul by Peter. You're a liar, and Peter's my mentor. I'm going to make Peter look good. Yet the shortest gospel written by Mark has got the most detailed exposure of Peter's failure, who was said to be the rock foundation of the church. Now, if you're liars, you can embellish the portrait of your mentor. You don't have to make him look the worst of all the other reporters. And the reason this suggests honesty is Mark was a failure. Most think he was the young man who ran in fear and lost his garment the night of the crucifixion. It was his mother's house where the Last Supper was held. He goes with Peter, or rather with Paul, on a missionary journey. Too tough. And he's sent home. And he ends up, after Barnabas, with Peter. And I can imagine them sitting around campfires and Mark saying, "I really failed." And Peter saying, "Let me tell you about mine." That's why Mark would know. This is speculation. And later, Paul's going to say, "Send Mark, he's good for me," because he made it. Mark, the shortest gospel, paints the worst portrait of Peter. Everybody agrees Mark wrote either to Romans or the Egyptians. They're Gentiles. They know nothing about the book of Enoch, nothing about the book of Daniel. In the book of Enoch, in the book of Daniel, The word Son of Man is an explosive messianic divine term. In the book of Enoch, the Son of Man comes on clouds of glory to set up his kingdom. But to an Egyptian and to a Roman, Son of Man means mortality. Mark's writing to prove Jesus is the Son of God. Count him when you go home. More than any other gospel, he has Jesus refer to himself as Son of Man. That suggests internally honest reporting. If you're making up a lie, you know you're making up a lie, you're trying to make gullible people believe the lie, you would not use a phrase coming out of Jesus' mouth that de-divinity to make a word up him. Son of Man, to a Gentile, was a contradiction in the purpose of presenting him as the Son of God. And even though he's writing to Gentiles, he's going to be true to what Jesus said, and Jesus said it in a context where Jewish people were present who would immediately assume divinity from the book of Enoch, apocryphal book of Enoch, and the book of Daniel. The 7 weeks suggest honest people. They didn't consider, well, this is going to make the story look bad. If they're smart enough to get the story, they'd say, 7 weeks, let's don't mess with it. 7 weeks sounds like just people who didn't expect the resurrection, are surprised by it, told they're going to be witnesses to the whole world, but don't go until you receive power, and go to Jerusalem, and tarry till you receive the power. And they go and they wait. And since the harvest festival, as G. Campbell Morgan has said, when the day of Pentecost began to be fulfilled, as all these types were shadows of things to come, Pentecost became the explosive harvest beginning. These are simple-minded men who are doing what they were told, waiting 7 weeks. Internal evidences. If you're going to tell a story that you know is a lie and you want it to be believed, this may be hard on you ladies to accept in the 20th century. But in that century, women were considered incompetent, unreliable witnesses. You could not base anything on the testimony of women in that generation. Now, if you're going to tell a lie to a generation, and since you know you're telling a lie, you're not going to have much of a miracle expectancy yourself. You know you're telling a lie. So why would you weaken your case by having incompetent, unreliable witnesses bearing the first testimony of the resurrection? Women. If you're alive. Look, come on, congregation. If we made this lie up, aren't we smart enough to not have a woman given the first report? I mean, no. Now it's okay. But if we were in the first generation, well, they couldn't even be witnesses. They were considered incompetent, unreliable. That was worse than before they were allowed to vote for the same reason. You don't let women vote. Women are incompetent and unreliable. They'd elect a monster. Now, I'm quoting an archaic, terrible view. I mean, I hate women because I recognize they're smarter than me. And no one finds it easy to love someone that you know is superior to you and knows that they know it too. It's easy to love people that are inferior to you and know it. And the greatest act of we archaic men who are living in the delusion of superiority is to fool the women a little longer and not let them find out they're superior. So I don't want you to think this is my view. My attitude toward women is because I know they're superior. I don't want them to find it out. I know the horse I ride can kill me. I don't want him to know it. You know whether I'm serious or not, do you? Would you tell a lie and weaken it by letting a woman be the one that gives the report? Internal evidences. Why would you, every report is uniform. Jesus didn't move the stone. If you're telling a lie and it's resurrection power, if you're smart enough to fool 2,000 years of the world, you got to be smart enough to figure out, let's blow that rock out. Just think what an impact. If you'd have blown it 100 yards out there in the garden somewhere. That's my Jesus. That's the way he came out. The point is, internal evidences suggest not liars, just simple men telling what they knew. Number two, internal evidences. But that, I wouldn't rest my case on that. I just think they don't sound like liars. More convincing, every one of them were cataclysmically changed. And the cataclysmic change is for the better. Now, you can tell a lie and it'll change your personality. That I believe. But not for the better normally. Every one of these men cataclysmically changed. Peter, consistent failure. Extremist. Unpredictable. That's Peter. A great failure. He's always blurting out off base on the wrong page. Jesus talks of the crucifixion. They're far from you. And he has to be rebuked. Literally. Get behind me, Satan. Jesus says, I'm going to wash your feet. Not mine. You're not washing my feet. But I'm going to wash your feet. You're not going to be in the kingdom with me. Wash me all over. All he wants to do is wash his feet. I ain't going there. Somebody's going to deny me, betray me. Not me, Lord. Though they slay me, I won't do it. Always unstable, going too far, overstatement. Betrays him three times, same night. From that instability, an event changed Peter until he became the rock on which the church would build, namely his faith and his statement of faith. And faced with crucifixion, he never falters again and asks to be crucified upside down because he's not worthy to die in the position of his Master, a change. John, one of the sons of thunder, wanting to call, he's a firebrand, wanting to call fire from heaven down on those that would oppose him. Self-seeking in his nature, he and his brother asking for the choice seats in the kingdom and then sending their mother to ask for it. Something changed him. From one whose personality got the nickname with his brother, Sons of Thunder, he becomes the apostle of love, embodying love, more than anyone else. To whom? The whole church points as the apostle of love. That's a change. Thomas, doubter. Everybody knows his doubt at the crucifixion. Not everyone, unless they've read as I've read or listened to this message at other times, recognize how woven again through multiple synoptic records, is this personality of the realist, the cynic, the doubter, woven rather incidentally in the various portrait parts of the record. It's always Thomas who's questioning, always Thomas who doubts. Jesus is facing a dangerous journey. It's a threatening zone in Samaria. Bandits, other people threaten the life of the traveler there. Thomas says, "Let us go with him, that we may die also." If he's going to make a trip where he's going to get killed, let's be at his side, shoulder to shoulder. Respect his courage, but he's talking about his master who said, "No man taketh my life from me, I lay it down." He has a total realist view of Jesus as a natural man, rabbi, teacher. He hasn't yet come to comprehend the divine nature and admire his courage, but it's the hard-headed realist Thomas. There's a threat, there's a danger, he might be killed, let's go with him at his side. Jesus is preaching about mansions in heaven. "I go to prepare a place, that where I am, you may be also. I'm going to prepare a mansion for you. And whither I go, you know, and the way you know." Now, all the rest of the disciples are taken up visualizing, I'm sure, their mansions. Old hard-headed Thomas is listening. And Jesus goes on to say, having said, "I'm going to prepare a mansion for you. And the way you know," he says, "I go away, and the way you know." Thomas, he heard about the mansion, going away, and come back and get us, and take us to be with him, and the way there you know. Thomas says, "We don't know the way. We don't know." Questioning, inquiring, always this trait. It took a genius. One has said, "If I didn't believe in Jesus, I'd worship those who compounded this lie." To weave into multiple incidental places, you don't see it if you look for it. This personality trait of the doubter. And he is the one, when the report of the resurrection came, who said, "I won't believe it until I put my hand in the very marks of his death." Now, Jesus did say it's more blessed to believe without seeing. But he came before Thomas, and like I'm saying about the sign of the resurrection, if you can believe without seeing, you're a lucky person. You don't have these problems with your head. But Jesus offered to submit to the very test that Thomas asked for. He said, "Behold my hands and my side." Cataclysmically, Thomas changes and cries out, "My Lord and my God." John never wavers in the changed personality trait to that final writing, banished to the Isle of Patmos. Peter, I've already said, to being crucified upside down. And Thomas, chosen to take the gospel across the Himalayas into India, the most philosophic part of the world at that time, never wavering in his faith until pierced with a Brahmin sword near Madras, India. This cataclysmic change occurred, and it occurred with the telling of this story and the subsequent preaching. Instability to stability is a change for the better. Hateful, self-serving son of thunder to the apostle of love is a change for the better. Doubt and instability and not able to believe, change to rock-sure faith, is a positive, cataclysmic change. And it occurred, it's as though you sliced time. And here they are, unable to stand with Jesus as a group. Suddenly, transformed by the telling of this message. They sound like people that believe. not someone who made up a lie. And the final two, you don't pay the price. There's internal evidence that they're not liars. There's cataclysmic change. Number three, the price they paid for telling the lie. Everybody agrees, except for John. Little details of the martyrdom may change. They all paid with their life for the telling of this story. And Thomas Aquinas, great proof of the resurrection, they made that payment. They died alone for telling this story. Now, I could believe, let's say, as I do each time, Dave, you're going to be Bartholomew. Bruce, you're going to be Peter. And I'm going to be Thomas. Now, I could believe if we concocted this story to save face and stayed together as a group, we wouldn't want to let the other party down. We have told this story. We spent 7 weeks and made it up. And we announced it to the world on the day of Pentecost. And we've had converts and early success, 3,000 in one day there in Jerusalem. And as long as we're together, we wouldn't want to break rank. Even under terrible persecution. I could even conceive psychologically, we three, forgetting the other 11, we three could go to our death as long as we're seeing one another rather than be the one that breaks rank. It's psychologically inconceivable. You're in Armenia. You're in Rome. I'm over in India. I don't know if you'll ever... It's a lie we're telling. So there's no God involved here. I have no thought I will ever see you again. I can't watch you on CNN. I can't pick up the telephone. There are no quick ways of covering the world. I probably don't even know where you're at. You're over in Rome. You're in Armenia. I'm in India. And they're skinning you alive, Dave, with a whip. They're going to flay you to death. And all you got to do to get out of that treatment, hey, we made it up. I'm sure if you'd been in our spot, it was a good run while it lasted, but I admit it ain't true. That's all you got to do to keep them being skinned alive. And if by chance you run into me, with your skin still on now, and Bruce, at some event, since you're a liar anyway, you can say, well, I'm telling you, boys, they really gave it to me back in Armenia, but I stuck to our story. How would I know? I was in India. How would you know? You were in Rome. And I'm going through the same thing. All I have to do is renege on the story. You'll never find it out. If I see you again, I'll just tell another lie. I stuck to it, boys. They turn you upside down to crucify you in Rome, Bruce. All you got to do is say we made it up. It ain't true. Lord Caesar, I bow to you. Why would a lie care? When you see us, I stuck to it, boys. It's inconceivable that one of these witnesses, if it was a lie, all of them died alone for it. It's inconceivable that one of them would not have broke rank. Impossible. Totally impossible. Find one. 2,000 years. Not one. Record or hint that any one of these testifiers of this resurrection ever reneged on their story. Not once. Nowhere. I remember doing this with Larry Thomas, my major professor, when I became his assistant in the final years at Stanford. And I did the same thing with him. And Larry said to me about this point, he says, "Gene, you got me unconvinced. These disciples believed what they were telling. There's no way I agree that they would die alone in far-flung remote sections of the globe, dying alone and thus not able to even be embarrassed, not even sure that their former compatriots would even know that they broke rank. It is inconceivable that not one of them would break rank if it was a lie. So I'm convinced they believed what they were preaching. Therefore," Larry said to me, "some one of your other eight facts must be wrong." I am glad to report that Larry, in later years, forsook his ontology of experimentalism and the philosophy of John Dewey that he had when I was there, and embraced a faith in Christ that assumed the resurrection. The details of it, I don't know, as we did not have contact over the last few years of his life. But my job's easy now. I said to Larry, I said, "Well, I got you now. Because these are much easier to prove than the resurrection. And there's only one Christ. And if he came out of the tomb, this is what he revealed himself to be. And I don't need any more definition of God than a person on the page of history, the words and actions of which were available to be searched, which is why I took the passion and made it a lifetime passion of these manuscripts, to get acquainted with the one who in my place embodied what I cannot do, fulfill God's law of perfection. The one who is all authority. I have a compass point for eternity from one who was inside. I don't have to memorize some new legal book of performance. It's a relationship like a love affair in a marriage. God has revealed himself in a person who gave himself for me, that if I will trust and follow him, he'll take me home, who's with me wherever I am and whatever I do. And all he asks that I do is trust him, who died for my redemption and my health, and who rose again to give me the hope that he is but the firstborn of a family that I now can be a member of. The resurrection is the cornerstone and the basis of that faith." They didn't preach a lie. These facts are much easier to prove than the resurrection. They proclaimed a truth that men without God's sense do not want to accept, because it involves accepting him as Lord and professing to be wise. They become fools and present a Christ that doesn't exist, and thus trifle with your brains and misuse their well-earned authority in their fields to accept their religious pronouncements as intelligent when they are moronic. Either cast Christ out as a fool or a con artist, or face the fact he confirmed his right to make those claims, and the evidence is there to look at, and I presented you the basis for my belief. He is risen and alive and well today, and that's my message for today. it's offering time. Offering time, please, as you leave, make your reservation for next Sunday. Voices of Faith, we need you at the studio, King's House 2. There'll be people asking, was that service live today? And you can tell them, well, the one you're watching right now is today's live service. I'm counting on you to make your reservations as we move through spring into the summer. Don't forget Secret 14. I'll be looking at you throughout this week. Expect you here next Sunday. Good day, folks.